another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream.
Hi folks, this is Jack Spirko here with yet another edition of the Survival Podcast. One man's view of the changing world and the changing economic times, the things that we can do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. What I've got to lead off today with, folks, of course, is Hurricane Ike. I've mentioned this storm a few times in the past week, and I try not to do too many things on this show that are, you know, time-sensitive, because people download this show at any given point in time. Somebody might be listening to this show a year from now. So I try to keep it mostly to timeless topics. I mean, that, you know, debt will always be bad, you know, liberty will always be good, having gardens will always be good, and having supplies for hard times will always be good, but there won't always be a Hurricane Ike to talk about. So I won't go too deep into this. I just, you know, I have people that listen every day. A lot of them are in South Texas, because I get emails from you folks, you tell me where you're at. A lot of them are in the Houston and Galveston area, and hopefully if you're listening to me and you're from the Galveston area anyway, you're doing it from a hotel room or on the road somewhere with relatives, because, and this is really what I wanted to point out today, that the National Hurricane Advisory came out, and what it said is that if you are on Galveston Island, specifically any area of the island not directly protected by the seawall, when Ike comes ashore, that you face almost, and I quote, and I hate to say this, but certain death. All right? That's from the National Hurricane Advisory, that's how serious, that's how severe, and that's how bad that the storm surge is expected to be here. Now, the good news is that the news idiots who seem to think that they can be hit in the spleen with a flying yield sign and survive are running around Galveston right now asking people, are you leaving? And the very few people that are even still there are saying, yeah, we're on our way out. You should probably leave, too. And looking at them like they're kind of strange for hanging out there. So it seems like Galveston is pretty much becoming a deserted ghost town, which is what it needs to be right now. You know, you have to listen to your government officials on certain things, and this is one of them. When they tell you to go, you got to go. If you don't go, then you're on your own. And that's what they're saying now, that if you're in an area that's told to evacuate, you should consider yourself on your own for at least minimum of 48 to 72 hours after the storm begins, because they're just not going to be able to get to you. It's not going to be, they don't want to help you. It's that, well, one, you've been dumb. You've been told to go and you've refused. So you've taken responsibility for yourself, and that's fine, but then you have to deal with that choice. And then the other side is they just can't. You can't send a fire truck out in the middle of a storm surge with the water 6 foot high in the middle of the street. It won't go. It won't happen. So it's not that they don't care about people. It's that there's just a limitation to what's, you know, humanly possible to do. And rescuing people in the middle of a Category 2, Category 3 hurricane with massive storm surge, tornadoes, and everything else that goes along with it, and flooding, is just impossible. You have to wait for it to end, and then you go in and you look for, you know, whoever you can help after it's over. And so that's the situation we're going to deal with there. Now, conversely, the city of Houston has been basically told, you know, we're not going to clog the highways like we did with Rita. Looks like the safest thing to do is stay in place. Make sure you got water. Make sure you got food. Of course, if you're a prepper, you've already done that a long time ago. And stay in your homes for about a day. Because one saving grace of this storm, and it may save a lot of lives, it's quite fast moving for a hurricane. And it's expected, to give you an idea of the speed of this thing, it is expected to land on the Texas coast on Saturday morning, about 2 a.m. in the morning, somewhere around there. And by Sunday, it's expected to be in Oklahoma. All right? And if you compare that, I don't remember what the storm was, the tropical storm that hit Florida. It caused all the flooding. It was a Cat 1 hurricane, I think, when it hit Florida, and then it turned into a tropical storm. And I'm sorry, it's not that you folks aren't important to me out there. I grew up in Jacksonville, which got a lot of flooding in the storm. I just can't remember the name of the storm. But it seemed like it was over Florida for days and days and days. And what we have here, excuse me, is the state of Texas, which is a very large state, And coming ashore and being out of the state in 48 hours is a very fast-moving hurricane tropical storm. That should help with some of the rain amounts because at least the storm's going to move through. Now, that said, this thing's huge. Right now, the projections have changed. It looked like the eye of this thing, what was ever left of the tropical storm by the time it had weakened coming across all the land of Texas, was going to actually hit right in the middle of Dallas. Now it looks like it's going to definitely go to our east, and since I live west of the Metroplex, that's good for me, and we should be all right. We do have, you know, isolated tornadoes to worry about, but gee, that's March, April, May, and June for us anyway, so we're just going to sit still and ride it out. My feeling, though, if you're in Houston, is in spite of what you're told, you need to take a look around you right now, and you need to decide where you live, and if there's bad flooding, are you in a flood zone? And you might just go find a hotel to your west and ride it out for a day or two. It might be the easiest thing to do. It is a weekend, too, folks. Call it a mini vacation. Hope you come back to nothing being wrong. You should be prepared to get out if you live in Houston. You mean, you know there's a risk there. If you're in an area that's relatively safe, you know, you probably need to follow your instructions and stay put and not have, you know, 4 million people try to evacuate in one day. It's a bit late to do that now, but because not everybody else is doing it, if you're in a bad spot, if you're right there on the bay or something, you should be able to get the heck out without having to, you know, sit in line for 48 hours to go 2 miles like they did a few years ago. So that's just my thought. And what I'm talking about here is if you're in the Houston area, if you're in any of these areas between Houston and Galveston, there's a feeling that humans, I usually say men, but when I say man, I mean like mankind is in humans, right? Now, I'm not putting women out of this thing at all, because women are usually better about listening to this than men anyway. And there's this feeling that's in us all, that's basal, that's at our core. It's part of that predator thing that I talked about yesterday, but it's also part of being prey. Because there's a lot of things on this planet that do eat humans. And humans evolved to survive and not be eaten by those creatures. So there's this thing, this unexplainable thing that a man standing in the jungle and a tiger is there. And he hasn't heard him, seen him, or smelled him. But the hackles go up on the back of his neck and he just knows the tiger is there. That voice, when we drowned out all of society and we listen to it, is one of our greatest survival tools. And all I'm telling you is, if you're there and you hear that voice, or if you're ever in any situation where you hear that voice, follow it. It's part of this lost thing called common sense, right? It really is. And to me, your common sense and your instincts are your two greatest survival weapons that you will ever have. You can own Glock pistols and AR-15 rifles and have, you know, bushels of beans and rice, and you can have stores of water, and you can have guards. You have all this great stuff. You can be ready for everything from a hiccup to Armageddon, but nothing will ever be more valuable than what's between your ears and what's in your soul. Those two things together are your driving force, your compass in life. And all I'm saying is, if that compass is pointing you out of an area, listen to it. Because how many times have we heard a victim of a crime say, I just knew I shouldn't have trusted them, but I did anyway. I knew I shouldn't have went back. I knew I shouldn't have went in there. I knew I should have went back and locked the door. There's all these things that you hear people that end up as victims say, that if I would have just listened to myself, this would have happened to me. And you see it with criminal victims, and you see it with financial victims. I just knew we shouldn't have bought that house. I just knew it was the wrong time to do this. Right? There's a time to be bold, and there's a time to take risks, and there's also a time where you really feel that inner pull to follow it. This may be one of them. And that kind of wraps up my stuff on Ike, and hopefully that's a good survival lesson as well. Because I want to go into today's topic, and you know, I don't think this is going to be a very long show. I've been doing a lot of them 40 minutes recently. This shouldn't be that long. But I want to talk about attracting wildlife to your home, your homestead, to your farm, whatever you happen to have. And for different people, this is going to mean different things. And obviously, if you have a half acre, you can't do everything that I'm going to talk about today. And if you have 100 acres, you can do more. All right. So, I mean, it's up to you what things you want to do. And a lot of it's going to have to do with the animals that are native to your area and which ones you actually want to attract. Like, some people would want to attract squirrels. And up in Arkansas, I kind of want to attract squirrels. I like to eat squirrels. So I have a lot of squirrels on my land. I can harvest some of them as I see fit, and I can eat them. And even though, I mean, I've done another show, if you haven't listened to it yet, I've talked about keeping small livestock. Man, you might think I'm a wimp, but I have a hard time keeping a chicken, feeding it by hand, and then one day killing it. I just can't do it. Don't have anything against anybody else doing it. If you want to keep some chickens and bring me one once in a while, I'll even clean it. I'm just not gonna. I just can't kill an animal that completely trusts me. I'm sorry, it's not in me. I'm a predator. I'm not an executioner, and that's just who I am. But you know, with squirrels that have a chance to get away, I have no problem hunting them. That's my natural place in the world, and that's where I'm comfortable. So I want squirrels in Arkansas. Conversely, I'm going to do some squirrel elimination with a pellet rifle that I picked up. I just picked up this Beeman pellet rifle. It's 177 and 22 caliber capable. Puts 22 caliber pellets out there, a little bit over 800 feet per second. And there's going to be some squirrels eliminated. And the reason is that's a suburban area. These squirrels are being fed by everybody. There's more of them than we really should have. The population's too high. They have no real predators. There are cats in the neighborhood, of course, but cats aren't the greatest predators of squirrels, especially well-fed house cats that won't climb a tree to get to the young. So we've got that situation there, and I only have one peach tree, and they eliminated all my peaches this year. So they are competing with what I can grow. So some of them have to become stew pot squirrels. Arkansas, I have a lot more land. I have a lot more space. I won't have one peach tree. I'll have 10. If they want to eat a few, they eat a few. I'll harvest less. I want them there, so I'll go out of my way to attract them. So, you know, that's going to be the case with a lot of these different animals that I'm going to talk about. If you are in a suburban area where people can't hunt and there's a deer problem, probably don't want to go out of your way to attract deer because they're going to eat everything from your azaleas to your beans. But if you live out in the country and you're going to do some deer hunting, you might want some deer on your land. And I might even give you some ideas about ways where we've had a lot of wildlife on our property, especially the place they used to have in Pennsylvania, where, you know, our garden just never seemed to take a hit because we provided them what they needed. So here I'm just going to start out with, you know, what animals am I going to talk about attracting? And I'm going to talk about the stuff that you know, it's all stuff that can end up in the oven as well as be viewed and appreciated. And if you don't want to eat them, you don't want to shoot them, that's fine. A lot of people just like to look at them, and believe it or not, hunters do too. You know, we like to see deer even when we're not hunting. We like to see squirrels even when we're not hunting. We like to see waterfowl. The animals are beautiful. We love the animals. If you're a non-hunter, that may be hard to understand. You're just going to have to trust me on that. No one cares more for animals than a hunter. And the animals in particular that are in most areas that people homestead would be squirrels, doves, and that's one that gets overlooked a lot, is the mourning dove and the white-winged dove, deer, rabbits, waterfowl, which I'm going to kind of just lump all together because I can only do so much in one show anyway, but ducks and geese, right? Turkeys. And I'm going to add one more that I didn't have on my notes because it just came to me, is quail. If you live in certain areas where there's quail, a lot of things we're going to talk about will improve their habitat as well. The very first thing I want to cover is, you know, most people when they think of attracting wildlife, the first thing they think of is, will you feed them? Put something out either, you know, manually or an automatic feeder or a crop or plant trees or plant something that they eat, and if there's food, they will come. There's a lot of truth to that. We're going to talk about it, but it's not where we're going to start. We're going to start with shelter, because shelter is the most important thing that you can provide for wildlife if you want it to come around and utilize resources. Now, if you have a small piece of land, odds are you can't provide a ton of shelter. If you have a large piece of land, though, what I'm going to encourage you to do is consider setting aside some portion of it as a protected area. And I'm talking as small as maybe a 5-acre plot, maybe even a 2-acre plot. A 2-acre plot, you might set aside a third of an acre to keep it really grown in. I've got 5 acres. I'm probably going to have at least an acre, and that's even with the fact that I have about 100 acres behind me of what's considered conservation land that will absolutely never be developed. But on this little piece of land that you set aside, what you should do with it is absolutely, totally nothing. Whatever grows, grows. No matter how thick it gets, that's how thick it gets. No matter how nasty it becomes, that's how nasty it becomes. It is a piece of ground that you allow nature to do with as it will. And that type of a piece of ground is a place where you'd be surprised on, you know, a 50-foot by 50-foot patch of brush. When deer get hunted heavily during deer season, midday, you send a guy into one of those if he can get through it, and you'd be surprised how many deer might be holed up in that one little patch where they feel safe and secure and where they know it's hard for people to get at them. And you'd be surprised how you could send a guy walk through there two or three times and then try it one more time and actually almost step on an animal and kick a deer out of there. Well, they've let you walk by them within 50 feet. All right, so that's one of the advantages of providing the little piece like that, little plots like that, that are available to animals to haul up. And it cannot be overstated how valuable it is to them, how much they'll appreciate it. And a lot of deer, in particular, if you're interested in attracting deer, they will bed in that area. It's also very attractive to squirrels. They like to use areas like that. Even when they're out in the open foraging, they like to be close to them where they can retreat back to them. So that's something to think about. And I just want to explain this. I'm going to use a squirrel to explain this because I think people don't appreciate how important shelter and cover is. I want you to think about, you know, if you had a piece of ground, let's call it a 100-acre piece of ground, and there were, you know, trees and woods around it and all, and you completely cleared it, like, for agricultural purposes, but you didn't plant agricultural crops, so you just cleared it wide open, and then about a 10-acre square in the center of it, so it was surrounded by open land, you put up a whole bunch of poles, and on top of these poles, you put perfect boxes for squirrels to nest in, okay? And you had an easy way for them to get up and go into that box. You put up some tanks of water so there was always water, and you covered the ground with acorns and corn and sunflower seeds and everything a squirrel could want, and you kept food there at all times. You'd probably be shocked that you would have no squirrels taking up residence. They just wouldn't go there. Especially if there's any birds in the prey, birds of prey in the area, if there were, you know, hawks and goshawks and falcons, if there was a squirrel dumb enough to try it, they'd get picked off immediately. Even though you've set up a perfect environment, you've got nesting boxes, you've got feed, you've got water, right? Everything a squirrel could want, but it doesn't have cover. And that's true about all wildlife. All wildlife needs cover. And any time that you're thinking about making your land better for wildlife, either think about the cover you're leaving on your land, or at least, you know, what areas around your land are buffer zones. And if it's public land where you can do some things that, you know, are not invasive and the government won't get upset with you for, or if somebody else owns it but they don't mind you doing some things like putting some brush piles in, you know, think about that as well. A lot of people are moving to the country where they're selling off lots, where the lots are pretty cheap and the major expense is actually building. Maybe they're doing, you know, 2-acre lots. What a lot of people are starting to do is they're buying a double lot, and then they're leaving one of the lots undeveloped. And that's nice to see. That's part of why the community up where I have my place in Arkansas, you know, there's no homeowners association. I already told you I think those things are evil. But there's very few restrictions, and one is simply that you can only have one occupied structure per 5 acres. That's simple. One house per 5 acres. And that just keeps everybody spread out. It keeps everybody comfortable. It keeps a lot of the wilderness left there for the wildlife. So, you know, maybe I'm beating this up a little bit, but it's because it's so overlooked and because it's so important. Now, in particular, if you want to attract rabbits, one of the things that you can do is as you do some brush clearing or you just do some tree trimming or stuff, create what are called brush piles. And these are just little piles, exactly what they, you know, no genius to figure out what a brush pile is. It's a pile of cut trees and limbs and stuff that the rabbits tend to go in, and they usually either nest directly in, or a lot of times they'll put burrows inside of them. And anybody that's done any rabbit hunting knows that when you're out in the farms and you come along a wood lot in the middle of the farms or a tree line and there's a brush pile, well, one guy goes to one side of it and the other guy goes on the back side of it and starts kicking it, and a lot of times a rabbit will come out of there. And that's because, you know, rabbits like brush piles. So that's a great way to increase the population of rabbits on your land. I have two things to say about this. Number one, more small brush piles are better than a couple big giant ones. They do not need to be very large. In fact, they should not. Something that takes up the surface area of your average passenger car and is maybe a foot high is plenty big enough. Rabbits will utilize that. Okay? And then number two is brush piles are a fire risk. They are a fire hazard. Okay? Plain and simple. And because of that, it is important, one, to follow rule one, smaller and, you know, smaller and spread out rather than giant ones clumped together. And then isolating them is probably a good idea. In other words, they might have a patch of woods on one side of them, but they're out toward the edge of that patch. And you should have natural fire breaking between your structures, your home, your outbuildings, and your brush piles. So if they do catch fire, the only thing between them and your house is open grass. Hopefully it's green and not in the middle of the winter. Another thing that you should probably think about if you build these small brush piles, once they get really, really dry and really, really rotted, you could then move them to a safe place and burn them and replace them. So maybe you take out, if you have 10 brush piles on your property, this would be a fairly large property, but if you did, maybe every year you remove two and replace them. I mean, that's, you know, a way to do that. Just don't build these huge. I've seen people build huge, long lines of brush pile. You know, 100 feet long, seriously, along tree lines on farm fields. 100 feet of brush pile long. 4 or 5 feet high, 8 feet across, like a big dam. First of all, it does work like a dam with the flood situation, so that's bad. But, I mean, if that catches fire, folks, that can start major, major problems for you. It's basically a 100-yard-long wick. So think about that with your brush piles, but it is a great option if you do it right safely for attracting especially rabbits, and then other wildlife will use them as well. And then one of the things that you could actually do where you actually, you know, directly, you know, create something for wildlife is creating nesting boxes. I'll put a link to some squirrel nesting boxes that you can build on the show notes to this show at thesurvivalpodcast.com. You should give squirrels nesting boxes that are well spread out. I'm not going to try to give you exact hard figures, but what I'll tell you is basically about 3 boxes per acre is all you really need with squirrels. Too many more than that, they won't get used. You can go up as high as 5 or 6 because a lot of times a sow squirrel, which we call a female squirrel, when she has her babies, she might use 2 or 3 nests before that group of babies is raised and out of the nest. Once they build up a lot of fleas in one box, she'll just go find another nest, and she'll pick her babies up in her mouth, and she'll move them like a dog moves its pups to another spot that's free of fleas because they don't know how to get rid of fleas any other way. So, you know, 3 to 5 nesting boxes per acre is about as high a density as is going to be useful. And then, you know, if you have water on your property, if you're lucky to live in a wetland area or something, you can put up wood duck boxes. As a teenager, I did a lot of work putting up wood duck boxes as a volunteer for a local chapter of Ducks Unlimited up in Pennsylvania, and that's really helped restore the wood duck to a good population. So that's something else that you can do that's concrete, and then you can create, you know, nesting boxes for other things. Generally, you know, with what we're talking about there, with you know, quail, they don't need your nesting boxes. Doves don't need nesting boxes. They pretty much take care of themselves and fly wherever they need to go. Turkeys, yeah, you know, don't need it. Deer, don't need it. So, you know, we're talking pretty much for the animals we're talking about here is wood ducks and squirrels. But that said, it's a great tool. It's a great way to make your property more attractive to them, and it's part of that shelter component. So let's move on to feeding wildlife because we've eaten a lot of the show up already. There is no better feeder for deer and turkeys than a good old-fashioned bucket or barrel feeders that you can set off to go on timers 2, 3, 4 times a day, however often you want. And if you've never worked with a deer feeder, a lot of folks here listen probably have because they're probably deer hunters, but deer feeders have these timers that not only say go off at 6 a.m. and 6 p.m., for instance, but when you go off at 6 a.m., run for 3 seconds or 5 seconds or 10 seconds or 20 seconds, and however long you run, it will be how much feed it'll throw. So a lot of times when you start feeding in an area, the animals don't know the feeder is there yet, so they won't use it that much at first. So you might set it for very short bursts, 2, 3 seconds. It will throw a surprisingly significant amount of corn, which is the most common feed crop to go in these feeders. And as the animals start to use it, you may increase the amount of feed that you give them. Here's a couple things to think about. One, if you're worried about protecting your gardens, your crops, the more you feed them, the more they'll come. So the more of a threat they become to your crops. On the other hand, the more you feed them, the less they will need to come eat your crops. okay? Because there'll be feed there. So if you feed them very small amounts, you bring them into the area, but they're still hungry, and then they'll go and they'll eat your garden. So, you know, kind of think about that. But so you kind of have to balance that, and you have to make your own decisions with harvest. You have to harvest legally what you're allowed to, when you're allowed to, with licenses. But, you know, harvest is a part of that population control as well, and it puts meat in the ice box, and there's nothing wrong with that as well. So, but deer feeders are great. They're also a great way to use small-scale solar energy. The timers use a battery, and there's a lot of little different solar panel units out there. They're not very expensive. I've never seen one more than about $50. You mount up on top, or maybe you have to go up a tree a little bit, put it somewhere it gets good exposure, run a wire down, and it will keep your battery trickle charged. And since it only needs to run a few times a day for short duration, they can go for a very, very long time completely on their own, even in very short hours of daylight toward the winter. You also may find that you're going to do the most attracting of wildlife by feeding them with feeders like this during the winter months. And you may want to then, of course, up how often or how much feed you throw accordingly. And the reason is simple. In the middle of summer, there's for deer, for instance, or turkeys, there's browse everywhere. There's shoots, there's berries. And in the fall, there's nuts all over the place. In the winter, when it's really cold out, food starts to get short in supply. So that may be the time you see the most wildlife around your area. And it's a time where your supplemental feeding is most beneficial to them and will help pull more of them through those winter months. So it's not just about attracting wildlife in your area. It's about keeping populations sustainable during hard winters. So it's another way to be a good steward of your land and the wildlife. Another great way to attract wildlife and feed them and help sustain them is through food plots, growing food plots. And there's been more of that going on in the past, I'd say, 20 years than I've ever seen, you know, at any time in history for deer hunters and for land managers. When I was a kid, we hunted deer. No one knew what a food plot was. I mean, that was like baiting is what we would have called it. No one even thought of, like, just planting entire areas for the deer 20 years ago. People are doing it everywhere, and it attracts other wildlife. Rabbits in particular love to eat a lot of the stuff that goes in these deer food plots, which are made up of different clovers and different weeds and different greens that, that deer really like to eat. And you can buy different mixes. And I don't have any one that's a particular favorite. I haven't done a lot of growing of these things yet, but I know they're effective. And they're a great way to do things. Another thing you can do that I think is highly overlooked is simply having something as simple as a clover-based lawn. I've talked about this before. To me, a lawn that's composed of all Bermuda grass or all St. Augustine grass or something like that, and I have to water all the time, is completely useless. It robs from the ground. It puts nothing back. It's not good for wild animals to eat. It's not good for just about any kind of animal you would keep as stock to eat. You mix clover with, you know, Kentucky bluegrass, and you get a lawn that's beautiful. It feels good under your feet. And for those areas that you want covered with green and you want to be able to mow and you want a play area for kids or whatever it is, you end up with a nice, pretty lawn. Now, it may not look like everybody else's suburban lawn with perfectly manicured, everything's the same height, cut it once a week, cut it left one week, right the next week, and all this BS that we've been sold to as being a status symbol in suburbia, but it's pretty. I had about an acre and a half in Pennsylvania, and it was almost all clover and with mixed grasses in it. And it was beautiful, and I had a green Kemlon guy come and tell me he could get rid of all that nasty clover, and I almost threatened him to get off my property when I told him I wasn't interested, because it's like, how dare you kill my clover? And ironically, that year we got attacked by these grubs that wiped out my clover, but that's another story altogether. But you plant clover lawns, and deer will eat it, rabbits will eat it, and here's a trick for you folks. The place my grandfather had in Pennsylvania, where I grew up a lot and did a lot of farming and gardening with him, we had rabbits every night in the spring and summer in our lawns. And I'm talking a half a dozen to a dozen rabbits at any given point in time that you could see in our lawns, feeding on the clover, eating the clover. Right next to the lawn was about, I'd say it was close to a tenth of an acre garden. And we grew everything from cabbage to broccoli to carrots to cucumbers, all different types of greens, dillweed for making pickles, and tomatoes and peppers. And with that many rabbits, you would have thought that that garden would have had some problems, that they would be down there eating them. Well, the only thing that really ever took it hard was, for some reason, the broccoli and cauliflower, when the plants were really small. And we solved that problem by just cutting the bottom out of coffee cans and putting it around them when they were little. And by the time they got any size on them, they just seemed to leave them alone. But what it was is that the rabbits had no need to raid our garden because there was so much clover. And they liked the clover so much that they stayed out of the garden. And that's the honest truth. And we really never even thought about it back then. We didn't plan it that way. It's only as an adult looking back in hindsight that I realized, man, those rabbits didn't go in that garden because they were well fed. And we had a beautiful lawn, and all that clover was there. So that's, you know, the benefits of a clover land lawn. Then the other thing, especially with squirrels and deer and turkeys, is hard mass crops. And I'm just going to, you know, not going to, like, explain the virtues of each tree or something. Maybe one day we'll do just, you know, planting trees on your land or something and talk about these different trees and different aspects and how to make them work. But, you know, the ones that are really beneficial to grow in most areas of the United States are hickories, oaks, chestnuts, and you can get chestnuts to grow today. We have not many chestnut trees left in this country because of a blight that killed them off, but there's a lot of strains of chestnuts, and maybe one day I will do this tree show, and we'll talk about the different new varieties of chestnuts that are doing very well. Hazelnuts, both the American varieties and the European varieties, they grow more like a hedgerow if you plant them the right way, and animals love hazelnuts, and I love hazelnuts, and most people do. Walnuts and pecans. So if you plant, you know, a mix of hard mass crops on a fairly sizable piece of land, there'll be plenty for you and plenty for the squirrels too. And so it'll do two things. It'll, one, it'll add to the wildlife that comes to your property. Two, it'll add to the foodstuffs on your property, because the beautiful thing about things like walnut trees and hickory trees and pecan trees is you get up through that first 2 to 3 year period where they get a good root system down. And they start to grow. Once they start producing, they produce every year. They produce more every year, it seems, as they get larger and larger. They require almost no care. So you create a whole permaculture circle for yourself. Remember, we talked about the difference between permaculture and agriculture before. Agriculture, plant a crop, it grows, you harvest it, you got to do it again. Permaculture, you put a system in place that produces food for you or produces something for you over and over and over again where you don't have to really give it a lot of care. And all of these hard-mass trees do that, and they are absolutely essential for healthy populations of deer, turkey, and squirrel. So that's something you really want to look at adding to your property. And I'm going to do a tree show because I've started to put together a book on land management of a small game. And I go into great detail. So I've got a lot of research I could use for that. Where we'll talk about things like, you know, it takes a long time for an oak to start really producing acorns. It takes a long time for a lot of walnut trees, for instance, to start producing walnuts. So there's ways, if you don't have any hard mast on your land, to kind of plant some crops that'll produce faster and produce these long-term, you know, oak, for instance, might take a long time to really start to produce heavy mast. But once it does, it can produce mast for a century. You'll be dead. Your great-grandkids will be watching a squirrel eat an acorn from a tree you planted if you do things the right way. So I'll talk about how to blend those things, but just know this. Hard mast is good. If you are cutting trees off your property because you do want to thin some areas out, if it's a hard mast tree, you really got to think about it before you cut it. Do you really need to? Can you thin out some pine? And there's purposes for pines and all these other soft trees as well, and they're necessary as well. But hard mast takes the longest to grow, the longest to produce, and is the most essential to those three particular types of wildlife and other wildlife as well. So that's something really to think about and really use your saw judiciously when you start thinking about cutting that big oak or even that small oak. One real quick thing I'm going to say on trees before I move on is a lot of people say, you know, I do effective timber management. I go and I cut all the old trees, the big trees. But then there's all these smaller trees, these thinner, lower diameter trees that will then get bigger because I've cleared the area out for them. So I've created kind of a sustainable system. Done right, you justify that to some degree, but I want you to think about how many times you've looked at, let's say, pine trees that were planted by men and rose like a crop. all right, for paper mill use, right? And all the trees were planted at the exact same time, and a bunch of trees are big and a bunch of trees are real small and skinny. That's genetics. So a lot of times thinning that out, leaving those smaller trees, those trees might have been just as old as that big, beautiful oak you took down. And that tree may never have the genetics to produce heavy mass and to do the things. A lot of times, if you're going to do some thinning, you'd be better off taking the smaller trees out, leaving your older trees behind. Not only will they produce more, not only will they crown out more if you give them some space to do so and have higher yields, but those older trees are likely to have rotted limbs up in them that create the natural cavities that squirrels and other wildlife use. So they're one of the most important pieces of the ecosystem on your land. So if you're fortunate and blessed with them, they're not worth the money that you'll get from the timber mill. Leave them standing. You know, that's kind of one of those, you know, heartfelt pleas to you. You know, every time we cut an oak down, that's 100 years old, it's going to take a century to replace. And you'll never see it. You'll never live to see it replaced. So why take it down? That's something really to consider. And then the last thing I want to finish up with, and I'm not going to say a ton on this, is just water. And if you have natural sources of water on your property, obviously, improve them, make them better, make them accessible to animals. If you have a pond, one of the coolest things that you can do with a pond is don't clear out the entire banks of your pond and make it all where you can walk right to the water's edge. Leave maybe the back side of it with some growth around it so that animals can use cover to come down and drink. If you have streams, maybe leave some of it overgrown so that animals can use that cover to get to the streams. If you don't, you can consider putting in a pond. If you have a seasonal stream, and that's what I've got in Arkansas, I've got a stream that runs down the bottom land of my property, and it runs probably 8 months out of the year. And one of my purchases when I finally move there is going to be a little bobcat machine or something like that. And what I'm going to try to do is kind of create a dammed piece of that, but where when the natural flow declines, if as long as the land will hold it, I don't know if that's going to be the case yet or not, there'll be some reserve of water that'll maybe last until the next rainfall. There's not a lot of water on my land and a lot of water on that part of that mountain at all. So I know that if I can create a permanent water source there, that'll be a huge draw to the animals during the dry parts of the year. So I'll attract more wildlife. They'll utilize the areas that I put aside for them more. And I'll also help sustain them through tougher times. So again, I get the benefit of having the wildlife there, and I'm also being a good steward of the land, and that's really what we're talking about here. And then there's always the simple option of putting in some tanks. And I do have a well with an almost unlimited supply of water from my well. So if the stream can't be dammed, I can put in a 500-gallon stock tank, kind of bury it into the ground down in the bottom area, maybe even built up a little bit with some accessible areas for it. And could easily run water down there whenever I needed to. It's not going to cost me anything. And I could do enough rainwater collection to easily keep it full anyway. So that would be another option, is putting in, not stock tanks like we think of here in Texas, where we're talking about actually digging little ponds, but actually, steel or plastic tanks that are available you can do to provide water for your animals. And even if something as simple as like keeping bird feeders out, folks. If you do bird feeders, they'll attract a lot of birds and things like that. But a lot of times you'll find in the winter, if you put a bird bath out, you'll have more songbirds coming to your water bath than to your feeders. Because that's a lot of times in a lot of areas of the country, the winter is where it's really dry, or when there is precipitation, it's snow or ice, so there's not a lot of water to drink. A lot of birds, you like to put their seeds in water and soften them for certain reasons or certain things that they eat. And you'll see them take seed over to a bird bath. A lot of times we end up cleaning some sunflower seeds out of our bird bath because some of the birds, for some reason, like to wet their seeds before they eat them. I guess it makes them softer. So water is really important. I do want to throw one more thing before I leave here today. It's a squirrel feeder that I saw on a forum. It's a squirrel hunting forum. I think it's a squirrel dog hunting forum. I'll find it and I'll put a link to it for you. This is where I found this feeder. And basically what this guy did is he took a 4-inch PVC pipe. I'm going to build some of these suckers for Arkansas. And you can make that pipe as long as you want. So you can create as much volume as you want. It can be 6 feet long. It can be 8 feet long. It can be 2 feet long. And that'll hold an awful lot of black oil sunflower seeds. And that's one thing I wanted to make sure I didn't forget to tell you. If you want to attract squirrels, nothing will do it like black oil sunflower, and it's fairly inexpensive. And then you get a 4-inch pipe joint that's designed to allow one pipe to connect to another pipe at a 45-degree angle. So it's got a bottom that goes straight through, and then it's got an angle that comes out at 45 degrees. And you get a cap. You cap the bottom of it, and you put that thing on the bottom of the pipe so that if you hold the pipes vertical straight up and down, that T, that three-way, is kind of pointing up. And you, over the top of that three-way, you put a little flap of plexiglass. And again, I'll find this thread, and I'll post a link to it so you can see this thing. And that little flap of plexiglass keeps water from going in there. So it doesn't make your seed sprout and clog the whole works up. You put a little perch on it, a squirrel will easily figure out how to lift that plexiglass to get the seeds out. It's not going to impair the squirrel's ability to get to the seeds at all. And then you take a cap on the top of the pipe, and you don't glue it on with the PVC glue, you just kind of stick it on there to keep everything dry. And you wire this thing to the side of a tree, and you just fill it from the top with sunflower seeds. And you could easily make one that would hold 50 pounds of seeds at a time for a very small amount of money. So it's a great feeder option. So I almost forgot to tell you guys about that feeder. I'm glad I remembered. It is one of the coolest ways I've seen to make a feeder. And again, I will provide a link from the survivalpodcast.com where you can go look at one of these things. But it's a really cool way to feed wildlife. And you know, you could feed, if you put enough seed in there, you can maybe fill this thing once a month. One more thing before I go on feed. Buy your feed, buy your sunflower seeds, your corn, and any other feed you want. Find a feed store in your area. Even if you live in suburbia, I can almost promise you there's a wild or a livestock feed store somewhere around there. You know, even if it's maybe Tractor Supply, you're going to get better prices there than most retail outlets. But beyond Tractor Supply is finding a true feed store. You will pay 25% of the Walmart price at a lot of feed stores if you buy in quantity, especially deer corn. Don't buy 50-pound bags of deer corn from Walmart at like five times the market rate for shell corn. Find a feed store or find a farmer. If you live in a place where there's a lot of corn, you got farmers growing feed corn, they'll sell directly to you for cash. They'll be happy to. Nobody will pay any sales tax, and you keep money in the local economy. So think about that. Black oil sunflower with squirrels, again, wonderful feed. Black oil sunflower is hard to beat for attracting tons of wildlife. It's one of the best. And on doves, I didn't mention this either, but again, I try to do this out of my head. So white millet, cheap is all get out. And if you throw white millet anywhere where doves are frequent, you'll have more doves than you know what to do with. So there's kind of my ideas on attracting wildlife, and I realize now I can do quite a few shows on this because there's tons of things I'm leaving out, from different ways to make water accessible to your animals and putting the areas that are just good for grit, because doves like to use grit and pick grit, so, and then the whole tree thing. So I'll try to do more shows like this in the future. Comment, let me know if you like this type of show, if you want to hear more on this or not, because if not, there's tons of things that I can do shows on. I have all kinds of things planned, but I thought this would be an interesting and different show for the day. Remember also, please go by the survivalpodcast.com. Comments, questions, feedback is appreciated. Join our listener appreciation contest. We've now got over 600 listeners. We are 60% of the way to our goal, where I'm going to give away that free iPod Nano. Remember, it's one of the cool new Nanos that Apple just released. Just make sure if you enter the contest, you fulfill your obligation and tell folks about our show and advise them to have a listen. That's how we're growing this show so quickly and so successfully, and I'm happy to give away an iPod to make that happen. Again, this has been Jack Spirico with the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.